Welcome, everyone, to the Financial Sense News Hour. On today's show, we're going to be looking at the stock market. And with the nice run-up in stocks that we've had since the beginning of the year, coming right after last quarter's stock market plunge, what we want to do on today's show is look at where to place your money for the safety-conscious investor. Now, do you just jump on board and chase the trends in the stock market, get defensive, stay on the sidelines, and wait for the correction to play out? What do you do right now? In fact, what is driving this market surge? Is it momentum? Is it fundamentals? What's going on here? And in fact, the bigger question should be, what's changed here?
You know, when you look at what has driven this market since the beginning of the year, it's, you know, it hasn't changed, really. The LEIs we have been following continue to weaken and show no signs of abating anytime soon, both here and abroad. I mean, anytime you get an economic number, although the ISM service number did tick up here recently, but at the moment, recession risk look low, at least for the first half of the year, but liquidity remains poor. Recently, the recession indicator has risen from roughly around 11, where it was last fall, to recently at 20. Now, you really don't get concerned until you start getting above 20, you know, 24, 25, and then the risks start to increase. So the indicators we are following show a continuous slowdown in the economy, with GDP peaking in, let's say, the second quarter of last year. That trend has been weakening. We got the latest print was 2.6% for the fourth quarter. So we've gone from 4.2 to 2.6. And we've also seen, Chris, companies coming in and missing earnings estimates. Everybody remembers last December when Apple came in and they missed their earnings estimates. A lot of that blamed on what was going on in China, which is why there's such anticipation on whether this trade deal gets done or not, because that could change not only the trade picture, but also the earnings picture. So anyway, we're still getting warnings about earnings going forward. A lot of companies are saying, you know what, we're not going to meet estimates.
So taking that into consideration, given the fact that fundamentals aren't driving stock prices, what would you say is moving the markets since the beginning of the year?
I would say if there's anything that's really changed, it's central bank policy. I mean, you look. Take a look at where the Fed was last fall. The Fed has gone from its hawkish stance last fall to almost a complete reversal of that stance since the beginning of the year. I mean, the Fed broke the logjam in the markets by coming out with a more dovish stance. And if you look at it, that dovishness is being reflected in the futures market. Let me just go to give you an idea of how much has changed. We have gone from an estimate of 3 quarter-point rate hikes for 2019 to no hikes this year at all in just 1 month. That's how much it's changed. And since that change, financial conditions have loosened significantly, and we're back to, let's say, where we were last fall. Now, if the trends continue as they are now, we should see higher signs of inflation in the second half of the year. Maybe not right away, because like anything, it takes time to work its way through the system. I mean, if you take a look at what oil prices did to inflation last year, that's why the Fed began to see its 2% targets being reached. It was higher oil prices, and we've been getting those higher oil prices. At least we're in the 50 range. We're getting a little pullback here, but nonetheless, we've gone from the low 40s into the mid 50s. And it, by the way, it's not just here. The ECB did an about face on Thursday this week with a major policy reversal. They unveiled fresh measures to stimulate the Eurozone's faltering economy less than 3 months after they were phasing out their $2.9 trillion bond buying program. Now, this week, they announced three measures that they will be taking this year. One, they would extend low interest rates through the end of the year. It was supposed to end in September. Two, they would launch a new lending facility in September with low rates and maturities for up to 2 years. And three, they would invest QE proceeds instead of shrinking their balance sheet like the Fed is doing. Chris, let's play that clip as to what and why they were doing this.
Mario Draghi is cutting growth forecasts, announcing more cheap loans for banks. Our Steve Leisman joins us with all the latest today and the implications around the world. Morning, Steve.
Hey, good morning, Carl. The European Central Bank, a surprise series of dovish moves this morning, essentially reversing course from last year when it was maybe tightening up, now broadly downgrading its growth and inflation outlooks. Here are the actions taken by the ECB. It extended its low rate guidance from saying it will remain low through the summer, saying it's going to remain at current rates through the year end, launched a new lending facility, the old TLTRO, and it will reinvest the proceeds from QE. Had been doing that, but now looks like it's extending it. Draghi pointed to both domestic and global factors for these policy changes.
The persistence of uncertainties related to geopolitical factors, the threat of protectionism, and vulnerabilities in emerging markets appears to be leaving marks on economic sentiment.
All of this leading the ECB to cut its forecast. Big, big changes. 2019, year over year, GDP 1.1. That's down 0.6 percentage points. Less so for 2020, down just 0.1. Inflation, though, that's the big marker because, remember, it's just a single target central bank, down to 1.2% this year from down 0.4%. And that led to a sharp weakening of the euro. You can see that in the next chart, but also European stocks. 112.29 is the number right now. It's been straight down all morning. Let's look at a broader index of the dollar. That has strengthened quite a bit. And that's probably one of the reasons behind U.S. stock weakness. And all this, folks, will tie the Fed's hands. They're going to wonder how much of that European weakness is going to wash up on American shores, wonder whether they have accounted for all of that weakness in their forecast for the U.S. Second, they're going to be hard-pressed to raise rates this year now that the ECB is firmly going the other way once again, Sarah.
Okay, so it wasn't fundamentals driving this market, but central bank policy changes. So given this fact, that's a change in CB policy, but what do you do here as an investor? Because we know that the Fed really could always change its mind again if inflation rises, or let's say the economy picks up a little bit of steam. But at the moment, they've said that they're on pause, but have not said that they're done raising interest rates in this cycle. So we really haven't gotten the all-clear signal yet. And in fact, Jim, you did an interview on FS Insider with Danielle DiMartino Booth, who used to work at the Dallas Fed. She wrote a book on the Fed. And you asked her in that interview why they always get it wrong when it comes to raising interest rates. And this is what she said.
Because the first lesson that I learned on day one at the Fed is that monetary policy acts with a lag of 9 to 24 months. So you should be aware that from the first time you raise interest rates, there's going to be a lagged effect before they have the stunting effect on the economy. Same thing with easing. There's going to be 9 to 24 months before all that easing works its way into the economy. So why they don't understand that the tightening that they do is going to take time to show up and not be immediate is beyond me. Because again, they're the ones who wrote the rule.
You know, it just isn't the Fed that's changing its tune. We just mentioned the ECB just did a major reversal on policy this week following the Fed, but it's also China.
The Chinese injected a record 5% of their gross domestic product into their markets in 1 month's time, in January. That is how stressed out Chinese policymakers were that their economy was slowing such that they effectively printed 5% of their economy in 1 month and pushed that stimulus through, which was highly beneficial in terms of liquidity being agnostic, if you will, across global frontiers. That liquidity was highly beneficial to all risky assets. In addition to that, you also had share buybacks jump into super high gear right after the blackout window closed in January. That kind of turbocharged the rally. And then, of course, you had Powell blowing a huge air kiss to the market and saying, I used to be a hawk, but now I have found my way. Praise God. I might even embrace quantitative easing one day if necessary. Everybody can stop worrying now. I am a Yellen clone. And so you have these three factors that were effectively a massive shot in the arm of liquidity and confidence into risky assets, even though we have not seen a scintilla of improvement in the hard economic data.
So recent market action is based on a reversal of CB policies. What do you expect to happen next, Jim?
You know, I believe GDP is going to continue to slow down here, but let's put it this way. If a trade deal is reached between the U.S. and China, That could give a boost to global economies in the short run, but fiscal stimulus is going to wane as we get closer to the fall. Everybody remembers it was not just the tax stimulus that went into effect in 2018. They also passed $300 billion of additional spending. Now, the government's fiscal year ends in September, and that fiscal stimulus will come to an end. But fiscal stimulus, as we talk about, unless they do something different, you know, what's going to revitalize the economy? The Fed at this point says, okay, we're on pause. But as DeMartino said in that clip that we played, you know, it takes anywhere from 18 to 24 months for all those things to work their way through the economy. And you're starting to see it in a little bit. You're seeing it in housing with mortgage rates, a slowdown in new sales, existing sales, housing starts. You're seeing it in auto sales. You're seeing a little bit reflected in retail sales. So if we look at what could happen, we could see the U.S. continue to slow down while stimulus by the ECB, the Bank of Japan, and the Bank of China provide stimulus to global economies. So the playbook might be, as the U.S. slows down, we see a pickup in growth globally. It is one reason you've seen emerging markets perform much better this year, and a reason why our technician Ross LaDuke at Vermilion likes emerging market as a stock play for the rest of the year. Remember, it got pretty hammered last year. Emerging markets were down 25 to 30%. Now, if the economy continues to weaken, as I expect, look for further policy changes coming from the Fed with hints that, well, maybe they're just about ready to wind down QT and the possibility of hints at switching to a possible QE. Remember, right now, the futures market is basically saying no rate hikes this year. And it's one reason we're watching global PMIs abroad and here as well as the LAIs, because it's going to give you a heads up as to what central banks are going to be doing. So much of what has happened in this economic recovery has been a result of a central bank action, the Fed going to 0% interest rates, then QE, and then also government action, including last year, being a good example with fiscal stimulus, along with a major tax stimulus. All of that coming at the end of a business cycle. Who knows? We may be getting to the point where governments just keep this perpetual stimulus going because there is just so much debt in the system right now, they can't afford to go through a major recession or a bear market.
Well, you know, it's interesting because Fed Governor Williams just gave a speech saying really the same thing you just said, that economic growth is going to come down to 2% this year.
John Williams is speaking today at the Economic Club of New York, and he's practically listening to this conversation. He says the current funds rate of 2.4% puts us, quote, right at neutral. Why is this important? Well, Williams is one of the top three policymakers, I'd say, at the Federal Reserve. You have the chairman, the vice chairman, Clarida, and then the New York Fed president. That troika, I guess you'd call it, are the big three. And John Williams practically wrote the book on what the neutral rate is. So he says, expect growth to slow considerably this year to 2%. Why? Because labor force and productivity growth have both slowed, and he doesn't see those two factors changing anytime soon. He says some of the tailwinds from 2018, which gave us that stronger growth, have reversed. They include global growth, the fiscal stimulus, and accommodative financial conditions. Those are blowing the other way right now. Trade negotiations, he says, listening in on this conversation you guys were just having, those concerns loom large, and he also refers to Brexit. Tighter financial conditions this year will restrain firms and consumers. But he says, don't be alarmed. Slower growth, he says, is, quote, the new normal we should expect. He says the economy right now, about as good as it gets.
So outside of emerging markets, Jim, what about U.S. stocks? What do you like here?
You know, when you look at current valuations, which I want to point out is not a perfect timing tool, but valuations are stretched. I mean, let's begin with the major indexes that most people follow. We'll begin with the Dow. Current P.E. multiple is a little over 16. Forward P.E. multiple is over 15. Head to the S&P, the current P.E. ratio is 18. Forward P.E. is almost about 17. In the NASDAQ, the P.E. ratio is about 31. Forward P.E. is about 21. So if you are buying stocks, whether they're big cap Dow stocks or S&P companies or technology related NASDAQ stocks, you are paying high multiples to own them. For most of this bull market, growth stocks have been the place to be as a result of the slower economic growth, both here and abroad, and that's what Fed Governor Williams was making mention, saying that slower growth is really the new normal. When you have an economy that's growing at less than 2% a year, investors are willing to pay up for growth, which was one of the reasons you saw the rise of the FANG stocks and many of these companies reaching trillion-dollar valuations that we saw in the fall of last year. But after the big sell-off in tech in the fourth quarter of last year, these stocks still remain expensive. Amazon still sells at 80 times earnings, Alphabet at 26, Netflix, that's 131 times earnings, Microsoft at 26. The only FANG stock that is reasonably priced is Apple at 14, but there's some concerns there because the bulk of their sales come from their smartphones. So can that one product carry the company forward? So there is some concerns regarding Apple's future growth. But and there was an article, folks, get ready. I mean, this technology just keeps changing. Samsung is coming out with a flip phone that will fold open in double its expanse. It'll almost be the equivalent of a mini iPad. Any idea how much this thing's going to sell for, Chris?
Well, with the price tag on the last Apple phone, that went through the roof. I can't imagine what this one's going to be.
Well, just for a measly $1,900.
Oh.
You know.
Well, then most folks will probably pick up two.
Yeah, but seriously, unless there's something that comes out in the smartphone, and this 5G and plus the double screen may be the thing that sets smartphone growth on the rise again, but the only cheap stock out there in technology, there's a few of them out there that have been beaten up, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But if you take a look at those growth stocks, they're still pretty high priced outside of Apple. Now, the bulls would argue there's no price too high to buy a good growth company. In another version, in this time, it is different. Reminds me sort of the Nifty 50 stocks in the 70s, the must-own growth stocks that you wanted to buy and own no matter what the price was, because their growth rates would make up for the high price with the accelerated growth. That was sort of the story you heard about the FANG stocks. Now, we heard that same story during the tech bubble, and we all know what followed. So at this stage of the market cycle, I think you have to think defensively and you have to think of value. Believe it or not, there are a few tech stocks that are out there. They're out of favor. They sell at low multiples with dividend yields in the 4% plus range, which is what I like. Now, many of these companies have seen sell-offs in their stocks. And, you know, some of these companies are down 40%, so the low multiples and the high dividends. Now, it's interesting if you look at who is buying this rally, because, you know, a lot of people are saying, what caused? We just talked about, you know, what's driving this market? Well, it's a change in central bank policy. It certainly wasn't earnings or fundamentals. But who's buying this market and who's selling? According to the latest report from Sentiment Traders, recent report in January, smart money has been selling while dumb money has been buying. Large players in the futures market continue to sell while small investors and index investors continue to buy. Those are not the ideal buying conditions if you're an investor. You want to see the opposite. You want to see dumb money selling in a panic mode and smart money buying, as we saw in February of last year and last summer. And you also want to continue to see cumulative fund flows that are near multi-year lows currently. So what you're seeing, in my opinion, is distribution in the markets from strong hands over to weak hands.
Well, what I found interesting is the point that you brought up in the first hour with our technician about the breakout in utilities and REITs. This is really usually a very defensive position. So would you end up being defensive here, Jim?
Well, you know, when you take a look at valuations, I like value and high dividend plays here. Most of what we are buying and what I'm buying personally are value plays with high dividends, companies that are blue chip companies. I've been buying a few tech stocks that have been beaten up and are down over 30% from their highs. But what I like about them is, at least in this kind of market where you can be up 1 week or up several weeks and then give it all back in a couple of weeks. But the dividend yields on these stocks range from 3.5 to 4.5. If you look in the energy sector, it ranges from 4 to 6. That gives you a margin of safety, and that's what gives me a level of comfort. So I still like tech. I just avoid high-priced tech. I own 3 beaten-up tech stocks right now, and I'm looking to buy a 4th. But at this point in the cycle, I don't like to touch a stock unless it has a dividend yield at minimum of 3.5%, but most of what I've been buying pays over 4, which I like much better.
What other areas would you say that you like here besides beaten down tech? And I'm curious what your take is on defensive stocks like staples and healthcare. You've talked about energy for the past year, so I know you like energy. Is energy still on your shopping list of things that you like and are buying?
You know, I still like energy stocks, and especially the large international oils. I mean, if you look at the U.S. shale and the shale patch, it's now being taken over by the majors. If you look at what is happening in the Permian drilling, it has plateaued in recent months, but production is still growing. But here's the thing. The majors' changes are coming to shale as a result of the oil majors taking over shale. They are now beginning to dominate the sector rather than, let's say, the mom-and-pop shale companies that really started this whole thing. You take a look at ExxonMobil and Chevron. They just held investor conferences accompanying their earnings releases. Chevron expects to double output in the Permian to 900,000 barrels per day over the next 5 years. ExxonMobil expects to top 1 million barrels a day in the same time frame. So if you look at the shale game, it's becoming a scale game. Companies who have scale, operational expertise, and especially large amounts of capital are taking over shale. That is why you're seeing all the oil majors move in. If you look at Texas right now and the major shale plays there, we now have Exxon, Chevron, BP, Royal Dutch, Occidental Petroleum are now making up 16% of production compared to, let's say, 9% a few years ago, and that percentage is expected to go over 20 and 30%. I mean, if you take a look at Exxon alone, they have 48 rigs operating, making up almost 10% of all drilling in the Permian. And the majors, because of their scale, they're a little bit different. They brought down their costs. Chevron recently reported their costs in the Permian are down by 40%, and Exxon in its conference said they can make a 10% return with oil prices as low as $35 a barrel. We're currently over 50. So if you're looking at a safe way to play shale, I would stick with the majors. A couple of reasons why. They have a stronger balance sheet. Two, they're well capitalized. Three, they have the knowledge. Four, scale and expertise to make money versus, let's say, the mom and pop operators who continue to this day to lose money and they have to rely on borrowed funds. Sooner or later, a lot of that funding is going to dry up when credit spreads widen as the economy weakens. Then you're going to see a pullback by lenders, and these companies could have some trouble rolling over that debt. The other advantage, too, is dividend yields on the majors range from anywhere from 4 to 6%. So, you know, as a full disclosure, I own some of the oil majors and have owned them for some time.
But what about your typical defensive plays, Jim, like healthcare, consumer staples, and utilities? If you want to stay defensive.
Boy, if you want to play defensive, you're going to have to watch what you're buying because staples, utilities, healthcare are no longer cheap. And here's a couple things that you're going to be dealing with when it comes to staples. The issue you're dealing with is consumer staples is that they're losing their branding power. This is a very, very important point. And I want to spend just a few moments here. I mean, if you take, for example, the packaged food industry, first of all, grocery stores are selling more store brands versus name brands. A good example of this is Kirkland brand at Costco. Name brands have to compete with not only store brands for shelf space and price, but two other major factors play here, which is a change in, let's say, buyers' eating habits. More and more buyers are ignoring the middle aisles of the grocery store, and they're buying healthier foods that are either organic, natural, and they don't have all, pardon the expression, the crap from food additives, food coloring, to salt and sugar. In addition to store brands, they're being squeezed by smaller natural startups. Instead of the brands that consumers once bought without thinking, consumers are getting their information from other sources, food products from friends, YouTube celebrities. What has happened is that brand loyalties and what we used to call monopolistic moats are being destroyed by upstarts, store brands, and what I call the Amazon effect, which promotes its in-house brands through Alexa. So Alexa is a very popular device. A lot of people just say, hey, Alexa, I need Pampers, I need shampoo, or whatever they want to buy, and then Amazon will have it sent to you. Well, when you ask for a particular item, what Amazon is going to send you is Amazon's in-house brands. And so Alexa is a moat destroyer. All those billions and billions of dollars that were spent to build brand loyalty. Chris, a lot of that is going by the wayside. You've seen problems at Heinz Kraft. They recently not only missed their earnings, they had to cut their dividend. The stock was down about 30%. So, I mean, there's still safe places in the sector, but many of these companies are down 20 to 30% for a good reason. They're losing pricing and branding power and no longer worth the high price multiples they once commanded. You take a look at some companies, even like Procter & Gamble, which owns Gillette. Gillette, for years after years, they'd come out with innovative shaving devices and blades, and they kept raising prices. I use a Gillette razor, and I get them at Costco, and used to get a package of 16 blades, and it was a certain price. And then it was 14 blades, and then it got down to 12 blades, and they kept giving you less and less for your money. Now they're back up to 16, and it's much cheaper, because what is Gillette having to do? They're having to compete with Harry's and Shave Club.
Well, and that definitely obviously ends up benefiting the consumer. But Jim, what about healthcare, which has always served as a defensive sector when economies slow down and remain weak, but not to mention the fact that there are 10,000 boomers heading into retirement every day?
You know, I still like that area, but it's no longer cheap. Congress and the president are going to be applying pressure on drug pricing. There's several bills working its way through Congress. I know one of the things that the president wants to do is allow cross-border pricing, and so it kind of does away with some of these monopolistic moats. And, you know, they're going after the fact that drugs are higher priced here in the U.S. than they are, let's say, in Canada or elsewhere. Many, and the other thing that the drug companies have to worry about, many of the drugs are coming off patent and will and have to compete with generics. It is one reason why Big Pharma right now is diving into gene therapy, which holds probably one of the most promising advances in fighting major diseases.
Now, is there anything else that you do like in this market, Jim, that you think could be of further value?
You know, I do like gold and I like copper and base metals. As Frank Holmes and I were discussing in the first hour, copper inventories are falling and they're in a deficit. And, you know, think about the world we live in, this high-tech world. It doesn't work. It doesn't function without copper for electronics, especially for electric cars, silver for smartphones and solar, cobalt for electric car batteries. And it's one of the reasons it's rather interesting you're seeing a startup company funded by Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, Mike Bloomberg, and Ray Dalio Bridgewater called Cobalt Metals. The company is using big data in analytics, and they're modeling it to create what they call the equivalent of Google Maps of the Earth's crust, with a specific purpose to explore for new sources of cobalt. From what they're really looking for is reliable jurisdictions. Now, most people don't realize the issue of cobalt is over 60% of it comes from the Republic of Congo. Now, it is a necessary ingredient to powering batteries, which power those electric cars that everybody's talking about. Batteries are being used in a growing number of devices, not to mention electric vehicles. All of those electric cars you hear about in the news that are coming out over the next decade, well, guess what? They need batteries, which need cobalt. So base metals are in supply deficits for key commodities like copper, palladium. They are not finding or making major discoveries, as Frank Holmes and I talked about. You know, this applies not only with copper, palladium, but also to, you know, gold companies. And a lot of these key metals just come from a few large regions and mines in the world. So, number one, I like commodities along with energy. And I also think hedging a part of your portfolio with gold is prudent. I mean, the Fed is not far from ending its QT program. And this is if the U.S. economy continues to slow down, it will not be long before we're back into the QE mode. You just saw the ECB reverse course this week. They've gone from tightening back to loosening again. And you still have QE going on in Japan. China is stimulating its economy. So much of this should eventually be bullish for precious metals once the Fed softens and the U.S. dollar heads south.
So you're still nibbling at stocks, but more in areas that have been beaten up, pay high dividends, offer value and a margin of safety. Would that be a safe assessment of what you're focusing on?
That's where I would be positioned now, in my humble opinion. This bull market has gone on for, it has actually a decade long as of this month. And as we discussed earlier, all the major indexes are selling at high multiples or at the upper range of their multiples. So, you know, at this stage of the cycle, I like value. I like having a margin of safety rather than, let's just say, blindly chasing an index or overpaying for popular stocks. I also like the safety of receiving a dividend, so at least I've been compensated for holding the stock. You know, everybody talks about stock market returns over the long run that averaged over 10%, let's say, over the last century. But a good almost over 40% of that return came in the form of dividends. So, you know, the nice thing about, if you look, you can find dividend yields in 4 to 6% range, and those dividends go up each year, so you're keeping pace with inflation. And of course, depending on the amount of income you receive, here's another big plus, those dividends can either be tax-free up to a certain limit or taxed at 15% versus the high tax brackets on taxable interest that can go as high as 37%. Now, the other thing I don't like here is the economy and corporate earnings are slowing down. And that's why I tend to lean more towards dividends and the defensive. The smart money is selling, the dumb money is buying. So what does the smart money know that we don't know at this time? It may be just the fact that stocks are overpriced. It could be that simple. The economy is slowing down, that we know. And this rally is being driven more by a change in central bank policy than it is on, let's say, any fundamental catalyst.
Okay, so summing up here at this stage of the market, if you had to be invested in stocks, you'd be looking at value plays, companies that have been beaten up, that sport low PE multiples and high dividends that are growing. Your favorite areas are beaten down tech, some staples, energy and commodities, along with a small position in precious metals and base metals.
That pretty much sums it up.
Well, here at Financial Sense, we do want to let you, our listeners, know that we value your opinion. We enjoy what we do, informing you about the markets and what's happening in the financial world. It's fun, and we hope you enjoy listening as much as we enjoy being a part of this program. So thank you for your feedback. We get feedback in all forms, via telephone, email, even various websites designed to give feedback. So whether it's what you like or what you think could be better, please continue to let us know by calling, emailing, or sharing with the public. So, Jim, looking ahead, what do you see coming up in the weeks ahead? I mean, we've had a correction. What do you see forming on the horizon?
Well, let me see. In the month of March, we have an FOMC meeting and a press conference. All FOMC meetings this year will be accompanied by a press conference. I would expect, Chris, that we're not going to see any change come out of the Fed. They're probably going to say the same thing. Hey, we're on pause. We're data dependent. We're looking at this and we're just kind of holding back and watch how things play out. We also will be ending the first quarter. So it'll be interesting to see what GDP print. We got a 2.6% print trending down in the fourth quarter. It's expected the first quarter will be much less with that, especially with the government shutdown in the first month of January. Companies have also been warning, so we're going to be looking at corporate earnings. If you're going to miss your estimates for the first quarter, you're probably going to want to get that out a couple weeks before March ends. So all of that coming forward, and of course, we'll get a whole slew of economic numbers coming forward, and we'll be watching if this trend of a slowdown continues. All of that coming up in the month ahead. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Prytower and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.